This is VOA News by remote. I'm Tommy McNee. Myanmar's military announced a major cabinet reshuffle with massive removals and appointments hours after the country declared the state of emergency on Monday. Under the cabinet reshuffle, new union members were appointed for 11 ministries, while 24 deputy ministers were removed from their posts. That's according to a military statement. Union Chief Justice and Judges of the Supreme Court of the Union, Chief Judges and Justices of the Regional or State High Courts are allowed to remain in office. The move came after the President's office declared a state of emergency for 1 year, and the legislative, executive, and judicial powers were handed over to the Commander-in-Chief of Defense Services earlier Monday. U.S. President Joe Biden condemned the military's takeover from the civilian-led government Monday and its detention of elected leader and the Aung San Suu Kyi as a direct assault on the country's transition to democracy and the rule of law. As part of its ongoing two-week mission to trace the origins of COVID-19, a team of investigators led by the World Health Organization arrived at an animal health facility in China's central city of Wuhan in search of clues about the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. The independent team has already visited key hospitals, the Regional Disease Control Center, and the city's Hunan Seafood Market, where the first cluster of infections was believed to have originated in 2019. The center is the province of Hubei, and it could provide information on how a coronavirus endemic, is horseshoe bats in southwest China, might have crossed into humans. This is VOA News. U.S. President Joe Biden told Republican senators during a two-hour meeting Monday night that he is unwilling to settle on an insufficient coronavirus aid package after they pitched their slimmed-down $618 billion proposal. That's a fraction of the $1.9 trillion he has been seeking. No compromise was reached in the lengthy session. Biden first with lawmakers at the White House, and Democrats in Congress pushed ahead with groundwork for approving his COVID-19 relief plan, with or without Republican votes. Despite the Republican group's appeal for bipartisanship as part of Biden's efforts to unify the country, the president made it clear he will not delay aid in hopes of winning GOP support. The deadliest month yet of the coronavirus outbreak in the U.S. drew to a close with certain signs of progress. COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations are plummeting while vaccinations are picking up speed. The U.S. death toll has climbed past 440,000, with over 95,000 lives lost in January alone. Deaths are running at about 3,150 per day on average. That is down slightly by about 200 from their peak in mid-January. But as the calendar turned to February, the number of Americans in the hospital with COVID-19 fell below 100,000 for the first time in 2 months. New cases of infection are averaging about 148,000 a day, falling from almost 250,000 in mid-January, and cases are trending downward in all 50 states. One of Donald Trump's lawyers says Democrats are using the upcoming Senate impeachment trial as a political weapon to bar the former president from seeking office again. Trump attorney David Chuntz also said to Fox News that Democrats are pursuing a case that is undemocratic and unconstitutional. Trump faces a trial before the Senate next week on accusations that he incited a harrowing and deadly siege at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Democrats are aiming to link the violence and chaos to Trump's encouragement of his supporters to fight like hell against the results of his election loss to now President Joe Biden. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has suggested that a top European Union official should choreograph the United States and Iran's return to the 2015 nuclear deal. He made the suggestion in an interview with CNN that aired Monday. In January, he suggested that the United States should remove sanctions on Iran before Tehran returns to the terms of the pact. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda's Bobi Wine petitions the court to nullify President Museveni's re-election.
You saw how the entire electoral process turned into a situation of terror. And therefore, you know that any election that Museveni participates in can never be a free and fair election demanded by the Constitution of the Republic.
Ivory Coast opposition prepares for March 6th parliamentary election. Ghana launches a comprehensive maternal child health program. We'll have an evaluation of Zimbabwe's COVID-19 stimulus relief. And rights groups welcome the United Kingdom's sanctions on four top Zimbabwean security officials.
We had repeatedly raised the issue of serious abuses in Zimbabwe, implicating the officials who have been placed on sanctions. So this is really a way for the UK to show displeasure.
And environmentalists are concerned about lifting Guinea-Bissau's ban on logging. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Uganda's opposition leader, Robert Chakulai, also known as Bobi Wine, on Monday filed a petition contesting the January 14 re-election of President Yoweri Museveni. Wine's lawyers say they want the court to nullify the election, but also ensure that Mr. Museveni, who won a sixth term in office, can never run again. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
On Monday, just a little after 1 p.m. local time, lawyers representing opposition leader Bobi Wine walked to the Supreme Court and submitted volumes of documents they say prove why the January 14th election should be nullified. Lead lawyer Medard Segona says soldiers were seen invading polling stations and stuffing pre-ticked ballots into ballot boxes to inflate Museveni's vote totals. He argues that for decades, President Museveni and his backers have used intimidation and fraud to ensure victory.
You saw how the entire electoral process turned into a situation of terror. You get to the inevitable conclusion that he's the commonest and only common denominator in the electoral violence in our history. And therefore, you know that any election that Museveni participates in can never be a peaceful election, can never be a free and fair election demanded by the Constitution of the Republic.
Official election results showed Museveni winning a sixth term with 58% of the votes. Wine came in second with 35%. Segona says Wine's National Unity Platform Party encountered challenges at every step of the election process, including the beating of Wine supporters and campaign officials. The challenges continued into their efforts to file the petition.
They were arresting, torturing, and beating our coordinators wherever they would find them with DRA forms. They went to where we were photocopying form, arrested the person photocopying, and took them. The same uncivilized group came and took over our offices in Kamoja. We cannot access some of the documents. And they thought, rather mischievously, that way we would not be able to file this petition. I can tell you, we have filed it.
Justin Lumumba, the Secretary General of the ruling National Resistance Movement Party, says their lawyer is checking through the declaration forms from polling stations, which show how many votes the party's candidates received at each station.
We have a declaration form for the presidential from the National Electoral Commission, and when we are served, we shall respond.
This will be the fourth time that Museveni's election is challenged in court. Kizza Besigye contested Museveni's election after the 2001 and 2006 elections. Former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi challenged the 2016 election results. The two former friends of Museveni both lost, with the court ruling that even though there were several irregularities, they were not substantial enough to nullify the election. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
The battle lines are set for Ivory Coast March 6th parliamentary election between the ruling RHDP of President Alassane Ouattara and a united but not too united opposition. A total of 1,266 candidates are vying for 255 seats. The Independent Electoral Commission published the list of candidates on January 31st. Candidates who did not make the commission's list have 8 days from January 31st to petition. On the opposition side is the platform made up of Henry Kona Bedie's PDCI, the GPS of Gion Soro, the two wings of former President Laurent Gbagbo's Ivorian Popular Front Party, and Charles Blay Goudé's COJEP. As in the case of most opposition parties in Africa, the Ivorian opposition has had a tough time selecting and fielding united candidates. Jean-Gervais Tchéide is vice president for finance of former President Laurent Gbagbo's party.
As opposition, in the beginning, we had decided to go together as a united opposition. But on the way, it came up that some situations were very difficult to cope with. I mean that sometimes we have been able to go together for some places, but on other places, it was very difficult to come to a certain agreement. Maybe because every party was trying to get the seat in the National Assembly. So sometimes we decided to go everyone on their own way, but at the time we mixed, which means that, for example, a city where you have two seats in the National Assembly, we can share, which means that you give one to one party and the other one to another party. In a city like Yopougon in Abidjan, we are supposed to vote for six persons. So the six persons have been shared between three parties of the opposition. Sometimes we have been able to go together united, but sometimes it has not been possible. So we have to cope with it.
The elections are March 6th. How likely that you will be prepared for the election?
Now, one thing is to prepare your document to register, but another thing is to be in your region for campaign. So we have been preparing for 2 years. So we know that we asked for the election. We are ready in terms of contact with the population, campaign. We are ready. We are just trying to complete the process of registration. Once we have done that, everyone will go to their own regions to start the campaign for the election coming on the March 6th.
Now, the issue of whether Mr. Gbagbo's party or Mr. Bedie's party, whether you should have a united front candidate, now everyone decided to go by themselves. This seems to be a problem for at least most opposition parties in Africa. Everyone wants to be the leader. Is that the case?
Unfortunately, yes. But I must say that in the case of Mr. Gbagbo's party and Mr. Bedie's party, it is not exactly the case because, as I told you before, we have been able to go together for some places. And I can tell you that the number of candidates for which we have come to an agreement are about 112 candidates, something like that, because we are still trying to complete some documents. But at the moment I'm talking to you, we have been able to come to an agreement to support each other for 112 candidates. This is already a good thing. And those candidates are in places where we are traditionally the possibility to win the election. So normally, if everything goes smoothly, if there is no cheating from the government or from the Electoral Commission, we should be able to have about 80 or 19 elected persons for this election. But as you say, it is true that in Africa, and I think it must be the same thing everywhere in the world, ambition is personal and individual, so you cannot prevent it from developing. But we try to do the maximum for the united opposition in Côte d'Ivoire.
That was Jean-Gervais Tchéide, vice president for finance of former President Laurent Gbagbo's party. He was speaking with us from the Ivorian capital, Abidjan. Human Rights Watch is welcoming the United Kingdom's announcement imposing sanctions on four top Zimbabwean security officials accused of human rights abuses. They are also blamed for the killing of protesters following post-election violence in 2018. The affected officials include Owen Mumbe, the state security minister, and the heads of the intelligence and police services. Their assets in the UK will be frozen, and they will also be banned from visiting the United Kingdom. Dewa Mavinga is the Southern Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that a total overhaul of the political and security institutions in Zimbabwe will be key to ensure protection of the rights of citizens.
Well, as Human Rights Watch, we have repeatedly raised the issue of serious abuses in Zimbabwe, implicating the officials who have been placed on sanctions. So this really is a way for the UK to show displeasure at the leadership in the security forces, including the state security minister, the director of the intelligence organization, and the commissioner general of police, and a commander of the army that led the shooting of civilians on the 1st of August 2018. And there has been no accountability so far for these killings. The police in Zimbabwe have refused to investigate, and therefore it is important that there is international pressure so that at least there could be some accountability, some justice for the victims of these abuses.
Some Zimbabweans are saying they expect other members of the international community and perhaps regional bodies and continental bodies like the SADC and the African Union to also impose sanctions to ensure human rights are protected or respected in Zimbabwe. What is your take on that?
Well, it would be appropriate for the Southern African Development Community, SADC, or the African Union to place targeted sanctions on senior government officials in Zimbabwe over human rights abuses. But it is unrealistic to expect that SADC or the AU will do that, because so far they have turned a blind eye to the abuses that are happening in Zimbabwe.
But do you think this targeted sanctions would have the desired impact that people would anticipate?
These targeted sanctions might be too little, too late. The only major impact that they will have is a clear sign of displeasure by the international community. And we know that the Zimbabwe government has been trying to re-engage the international community. They have been paying public relations firms in the UK and in America to try and sanitize its name. So it is really about showing displeasure and condemnation. But in terms of pushing for change on the ground, much more needs to be done, particularly by Zimbabwe's neighbors like South Africa. Those would have a more significant impact if South Africa or SADC or the African Union willing to step in.
Some are suggesting in Zimbabwe that perhaps an overhaul of the political system would have a desired impact of having the rights of citizens upheld as one of the cardinal points for reforms, political reforms in Zimbabwe. Do you share that sentiment?
Absolutely, that is correct. There is need for significant political and security sector reform. You will recall that in Zimbabwe there was effectively a military coup in November 2017. So Zimbabwe's military is embedded in the civilian and political affairs of the country and is one of the key factors in the abuses going on there. So as indicated by the number of individuals who are all from the security sector, we have been put on the UK sanctions. It clearly shows that the major problem has to do with a security sector that is highly politicized and partisan in support of the ruling regime and is responsible for human rights abuses, and they treat each other as if they are above the law.
Dewa Mavinga is the Southern Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 2nd. During the first wave of COVID-19, Zimbabwe's government promised an 18 billion Zimbabwe dollar stimulus package to bail out the economy. Reporter Kuzai Navashi looks at how the package has performed so far and the concerns about future assistance.
Nils Bolza is the deputy country director for the World Food Program in Zimbabwe.
The numbers, based on the most recent assessments that we have shown that we are looking at close to 7 million people that need some form of assistance. That hasn't changed. But having said this, we are very hopeful to see a good harvest this year, which should be starting to come in April, May.
The food shortages have spread to urban areas, prompting WFP to provide support there.
Based on the assessments we have done late last year, we had estimated that around 2.0 million people, or half of all urban dwellers in Zimbabwe, need some sort of assistance. And obviously the first lockdown and now the second lockdown are further pronouncing this. It's in that context that we're currently scaling up our response in urban areas.
Bolza says WFP is supporting about 320,000 individuals, with plans to scale up to 550,000. In urban areas, WFP has resorted to cash transfers of $12 per person per month. Bolza says WFP is happy with donor support, but there is need for more.
Well, we are incredibly grateful for the support of our donors and partners. Many of them have stepped up to support Zimbabweans through WFP at this critical time. But it's important also to mention that we still need an additional just over 150 million USD to provide 4 million people with a minimum amount of food assistance over the next 6 months.
That would carry the country's needy through the lean season and hopefully longer if farmers produce a bumper harvest. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Ghana has launched a comprehensive reproductive, maternal, newborn, child, and adolescent health and nutrition strategic plan aimed at increasing equitable access to services for women, adolescents, and children by 2030. Mavis Ochery has more from Juaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
The five-year framework seeks to provide strategic direction for healthcare providers and other stakeholders to end the preventable deaths of women, newborns, children, and adolescents, and protect their health. Dr. Issa is a director of Family Health Division of the Ghana Health Service, which in the past had drawn up separate plans for health and nutrition care for mothers and children. However, he says the country needed a comprehensive plan to move forward in the medium to long term. He says the new strategic plan aligns with the World Health Organization's global strategy for women, children, and adolescent health. ISA says the plan also seeks to make sure the country is able to provide responsive clinical and public health emergency services to cope with the outbreak of COVID-19 pandemic.
To achieve the vision and the goal, we need universal access to better manage quality services. This plan also seeks to make sure that we are able to provide responsive clinical and public health emergency services when there's a humanitarian emergency, such as this pandemic or any other things which will arise. So, and eventually that women, babies and children not only survive deaths and disabilities,
he says in spite of the progress the country has made, 52 children out of every 1,000 live births will die before their fifth birthday, most of them dying before their first birthday. That is down from 82 children dying under the age of 5 in 2007. He says data show that from 2007 to 2017, Ghana reduced the number of mothers who die from pregnancy-related causes to 310 for every 100,000 live births, down from 378. Dr. Issa attributed the gains to the community-based health planning services, which brought healthcare services closer to communities, as well as the introduction of free maternal care through the National Health Insurance Program. Although Ghana does not expect to eliminate all maternal and child deaths, Dr. Issa says the new plan should drastically reduce them to a point where they are no longer a public health concern. He applauded the World Health Organization, the United Nations Children Fund, and other organizations for supporting Ghana's efforts in providing services to women, children, and adolescents to sustain the gains made in reducing maternal and child deaths. Dr. Issa says Ghana's government needs the political will to make sure that women, children, and adolescents have access to good quality health services and are protected from poverty, hunger, and abuse.
Also, there are certain activities where indirectly they go to impinge on maternal and child health. Such that you will find out that if there are child protection laws, gender-based protection laws and everything, these all go to empower the women, the children, and then they are able to live in an enabling environment, and definitely they are able to access service and then to be able to survive.
ESA says Ghana should find innovative ways to make sure that resources are well utilized in an integrated manner. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Jassu in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
Guinea-Bissau's Council of Ministers has proposed lifting the 6-year logging ban in the country, a decision that awaits the president's signature to be enacted. However, environmentalists say if lifted, the decision would be detrimental to Guinea-Bissau. Suzanne Breakoff is Deputy Director of Forest Campaigns for the Environmental Investigation Agency.
Lifting the logging ban at this point is a very, very bad idea, and especially since legal exports in the current situations would not even be possible in Guinea-Bissau. We have no scientific data on the tree populations. We have no inventories. There's no credible legal verification mechanisms to ensure that these exports are legal. This particular tree species is protected under CITES. That means it's regulated. Without these mechanisms, it cannot be exported. So technically, China couldn't even accept this timber.
If the country legalized, quote, logging again, why would the exports still not really be under international law allowed?
So CITES, Convention on International Trade and Endangered Species, is one of the very few binding international treaties that we have. That means that it can actually be enforced. And we have seen in the past in Nigeria, for example, that this can actually work if there is a will in the international community. The way this works is this rosewood species has been included in Appendix 2 of the convention, which means that the trade internationally is regulated. And countries are only able to export the timber if there's scientific data and studies showing that the species is not threatened by the trade, and that needs forest inventories and scientific studies. And there also need to be credible legal verification mechanisms to ensure that the legal acquisition of this wood. In the absence of that, technically, countries could not export or trade, which also means that the importing countries, in this case, that's China, should not accept this kind of timber.
According to a recent CITES report, there are problems with rosewood in a wide range of countries in sub-Saharan Africa, and they are recommending a, quote, zero quota for export from all countries. Can you tell me what that would mean on the continent as a whole if that was put in place?
What the recommendation precisely that is coming from the CITES Secretariat and associated agencies is zero export quota for all range states that do not have this, what they call non-detriment finding, which is the scientific evidence that the species can be exploited without threatening it. Currently, none of the countries has this information, which means every country should establish a zero quota. And what it would mean is that we essentially put a halt to this illegal trade that is currently happening to give breathing space and room for countries and for the scientists in these countries to do their inventories, but also to enforcement agencies and customs to build up capacity to actually be able to control these activities, which is currently completely out of control.
That was Suzanne Breakoff, Deputy Director of Forest Campaigns for the Environmental Investigation Agency. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Washington, D.C. And that's it for this Tuesday, February 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a great week.